Powered by volunteer community involvement, this is CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg.
Listening to Bikini Drive-In on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. Bikini Drive-In's mission is to analyze horror and science fiction films through an intersectional feminist lens while combining elements of screen and media studies, arts criticism, and women and gender studies. Since we'll be discussing portrayals of horror and violence, content warning, listener discretion is advised, etc. Also, spoilers ahead. Today I'm joined by Teresa Orozco. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
Teresa is a writer and zine maker living and working in Treaty One territory. Outside of writing and creating, she works in event coordination for various arts nonprofits, doing music festivals, literary festivals, and film watch parties and workshops. Her zine, Letters to John Goodman, An Exploration of Anticipatory Grief, is out now, and she's currently working on a new project to be released in May 2021. Can you tell us about the new project, or is it's top secret right now?
It's not top secret. It again has a long title because I'm all about long titles. It's called Don't Tell Me to Catch My Breath, Maybe You Need to Keep Up, A Polemic on Punctuation. And it talks a lot about oppression through punctuation. It's a bit satirical, but also wholly serious. And I'm looking forward to hopefully having it done by May. I put that deadline there so that I have to do it now
by that time.
The radio will guilt me.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Cool.
That sounds great. And today we're discussing the 1973 film Messiah of Evil.
They say that nightmares are dreams perverted. I've told them here it wasn't a nightmare, but they don't believe me. They nod and make little notes in my file.
Not far from here, there's a small town on the coast. They used to call it New Bethlehem, but they changed the name to Point Doom after the moon turned blood red. Point Doom doesn't look any different than 1,000 other neon stucco towns. But what happened there, what they did to me, what they're doing now,
coming here. They're waiting at the edge of the city. They're peering around buildings at night. And they're waiting. They're waiting for you. And they'll take you one by one, and no one will hear you scream. No one will hear you scream!
A young woman named Arletti goes to look for her missing father. Her trip takes her to a strange California coastal city called Point Doom, ruled by a mysterious cult of the Walking Dead. Teresa, what is your history with Messiah of Evil, and why did you choose this movie today?
So when the pandemic kind of first happened, to help with keeping my mind off of just the general dread, I kind of started a research project of going down the rabbit hole of 1960s and 1970s sexploitation in giallo films. And then I didn't really have tight parameters, so that snowballed into basically a ton of different lists and Word documents. And this film ended up for having similar themes, which I'm sure we'll talk a ton about. And it's been on my watch list for a year, and I've had the YouTube link just sitting in my watch list folder. So it was about time we talked about it.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I heard about this movie, I think through the Gay Lords of Darkness podcast. But yeah, it's been on my watch list for a while. So I'm glad I had the opportunity to watch it.
Yeah,
and it's interesting that you brought up giallo, because it does have the giallo and Italian horror movie sort of elements to it. Like, there's the colors, the setting, the fake blood is really bright red, and the kind of the pacing and the kind of confusing ending and the soundtrack, of course, too. So yeah, it's definitely like giallo light, I think.
Yeah, it feels like, even though it's an American movie, it doesn't feel that American. Mm-hmm. And I like watching it, I knew the synopsis before, but I kind of forgot about it. And I sat down and there's all these different like subplots you think are going to develop, but then don't, which is just so typical for a giallo film. And so there's like obviously missing some of the like true markers to a giallo. It's not Italian, but yeah, it's definitely giallo light. I like that.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about like what counts as a giallo movie, or like what are the specific elements of that genre?
Well, so like usually with giallo movies, I think like the most iconic is the black gloved hand that you never see the killer's form until perhaps the very end. And then it's usually like a Scooby-Doo movie where when they're unmasked, you're like, oh, it's that guy. And like a lot of, which we see in this movie where you have a lot of barriers over like the female form, kind of like masking and playing a lot with shadow and light and color and very sexualized, which I was shocked that this movie had very little nudity. I was expecting that there was going to be a lot of that, especially thinking of the time that it came out for an American film too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. That's really interesting. It's like they hint at some kind of like tension or like intrigue between the Tom and Arletty character, but then nothing really happens.
Yeah.
Which I'm kind of grateful for.
Yeah. That one scene where they like embrace after she's unzipped his vest. I was cringing the whole time.
I know. He's kind of a creep. He's just like, oh, can you help me with my shirt?
And then like his, yeah. Oh. His two travel companions.
I love them.
The younger, or the one who acts more like a teenager. Mm-hmm. I think Tony was her name.
Yeah.
Yeah, she was my favorite. But then thinking about that time period again, and like the Manson murder trial would have just had happened. And like you have this very charismatic man traveling with these two beautiful young women, and then trying to get Arletty into his fold. It just gave me all these weird vibes, and I thought something was going to happen there, but nothing did.
That's interesting to think of it like in relation to the Manson trial and the Manson girls too.
And then also like the cult of the actual, like, I guess killers of the film. There's almost two cults going on in competition for Arletty, and where is she going to end up?
That's so cool. It also reminded me of The Birds by Alfred Hitchcock. So like the sleepy seaside town kind of under siege because of this beautiful young woman has come to visit. And like, especially when you compare the sort of older looking ghouls, they look like they're dressed for a funeral compared to Tom and Laura and Tony and even, Arletty, like kind of like young hippie intellectuals. In a throuple, right?
It's funny that you bring up like The Birds. I did not think of that, but now that you mention it, I totally see it. I was thinking of the original Invasion of the Body Snatchers, where it was like very idyllic town, and that ending where they're both running away in daylight and the monsters are still coming after them. And we get that in this film too, where they think they're safe, and then all of a sudden there's one ghoul, zombie, vampire. Are we even sure what these monsters are?
I know. A combination of all.
So I thought a lot about Invasion of the Body Snatchers, and I can see The Birds for sure.
Interesting. I have a quote here from weareacult.rocks kind of about the sort of different elements going on in the film. Built as much on atmosphere and character as shock and horror, Messiah of Evil falls somewhere between arthouse and grindhouse, issuing gothic horror for the terror of modernity and updating its living dead antagonists to suit wearing middle class normals who happen to eat human flesh. I really like that description of them.
It's a perfect quote.
Yeah.
Also thinking about, like these suit wearing antagonists that are all almost middle aged and or elderly at some points, and not particularly scary when you look at them. Mm-hmm. But the few deaths that we do see are kind of terrifying. Mm-hmm. Like the mob killings in that grocery store scene. I don't think I'll ever forget that. Like that was such a beautiful scene.
Such a beautiful scene. Yeah. And like edited in a really interesting way. Like, you don't get like the typical sort of zombie feast shot of Laura getting sort of attacked by everybody. Like, they cut it between different shots of the grocery store.
Yeah, and those quick cuts like kind of prolong the horror of it a little bit. And then also it's just such a like juxtaposition to this person being mauled, but then we have this beautiful pristine grocery store and all the vibrant colors of the packaging, and she's being mauled by this group of men who are all in black suits. It's like, yeah, it really just makes it so much more unsettling even and scary, even though there's hardly any gore.
Yeah, definitely. And that sort of like editing and quick cuts, it's that happens again in the movie theater scene when Tony is sort of like, that's such a sinister, both those sequences are like so well done and like so interesting to me. And again, yeah, there's like no gore, but it deals with like fear of crowds and just like, I don't know. Yeah. It's very cool to me.
Yeah. Personal note, the grocery store is my most biggest fear. I hate the grocery store. I cannot handle it. So in that scene, I was like, this is really striking a chord for me. And then again, echoed in the movie theater scene when we have Tony and her death, it's all behind that white screen of, I guess, the theater. And again, this like mob wearing all black, mauling her, and then her hand comes out when it's all bloody. And that to me felt very giallo-esque. I really, really enjoyed the visual of that.
Yeah. Just to go back to your point about being kind of like afraid of grocery stores, like I'm like, especially now with like lockdown and like, and social distancing and everything, like I am kind of like nervous about going out in public. So I feel like those two scenes are really kind of like capture that. And like, yeah, this kind of like isolated ghost town, which is frightening when it's completely empty and kind of uncanny, but then also like extra frightening when there's like this slow moving kind of mob.
And like theaters and grocery stores are both expansive but confining, like
and kind of like intimate in a way.
Yeah, right? Like you're very much trapped, but you're still in a big space. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think really throws me off in my personal life about grocery stores. It's like I can't easily leave, but I also have tons of places to go, and it's like a labyrinth. Ugh.
Yeah, well, that's so interesting. Yeah, I just want to talk a little bit about the production. So like we said, the filmmakers were influenced by Italian and French and art house films, and that kind of adds to this like moody multi-genre feel of the film. They're also inspired by H.P. Lovecraft. I haven't really read a lot of Lovecraft, and the stories that I have read, I didn't really like them. But yeah, what about you? Are you a fan or have you read much Lovecraft?
I am with you in I've read very little and I was not necessarily taken by it. Mm-hmm. However, I feel it being referenced so much in horror films, like maybe I just need to drag my feet and read more of it. So yeah, I didn't pick up on any of that. That went over my head, but it was really cool in like when doing research, like hearing about that. Mm-hmm. But thinking about what you were saying about the filmmakers being influenced by Italian and French art house films, I like kept a running list of all the movies that like it reminded me of. And there was one that came to mind that was a giallo film from 1967. And the English title is Deadly Sweet. It's by Tinto Brass. And it's very much about like pop art, which we see in the production design of this film. And it was so hard for me to like separate the two. I felt they were very much in dialogue with those bright colors and like feeling very fun and almost like the art was a character. And I almost thought this was going to be a film that was kind of a criticism on art, but we didn't touch that at all. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I definitely see the influence in Italian filmmaking.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, like you mentioned with like the sort of pop art, we see that in the murals in Arletty's father's home, which structurally doesn't make any sense to me. Like it's like, obviously like with most films and TV shows, like the outside of like an establishing shot and the inside of like, like they're different places, but still like, it just like was confusing to me in a really interesting way. And like how the creepy murals, it's like all these people watching and lots of windows and like, yeah, kind of adds to this feeling of being watched by these like creepy townspeople or paranoia at the same time, right? And kind of adds to this like feeling of the uncanny, which we see in sort of like the isolated ghost town.
Yeah, and the use of silhouettes in both like the art that her father has painted, as well as when we see presumably the townspeople watching them through like a skylight, mm-hmm. is just so unnerving. And like you said, it adds to the uncanny and very much like giallo themes. It's just hard. Again, giallo light. I want to write that down.
Yeah. I heard it on a podcast. That's not even my idea.
Perfect. We'll have to credit them at the end.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so in this film, crew members were also in the film, and like producers and like producers' cousins were like in it, which I think that's just part of like independent filmmaking. And I just think it's just like so special and like cool. Yeah. Like I don't think you can really do that now. Like I was watching this interview and like all the cars in the film just belong to whoever was working that day. Which you can't do. You just like can't for like insurance reasons, and no one wants to get sued. But it's just, yeah,
cool. The 70s, we were just making films on a dime.
Yeah. And
thinking about, there's that one scene when Laura, one of Tom's girlfriends, is leaving, and mm-hmm. she's walking through what looks like a housing development going up, mm-hmm. and that's where she meets the man in the truck. And thinking about how that setting was probably done just because it was cheap to do it, mm-hmm, but right. also how much that setting like brings to like how creepy it all is. Mm-hmm. And yeah, thinking about doing things on a budget, but how that also adds to your storytelling in the end.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and apparently it's unfinished. I didn't realize this, but before like listening and doing more research and listening to interviews and stuff, but the film is kind of unfinished. Like it was taken from the filmmakers before they had a chance to like finish sort of like ending scenes basically. So yeah, the ending scenes were never shot, and this allows the viewers to either like read into whatever kind of ending they want, but also adds to this like general like sense of unease throughout the whole film. Like you could interpret the ending however you want, but it's still like, yeah, uneasy, and so much is left unanswered, I think.
Yeah, honestly, I wouldn't want them to have a different ending. Like if they tried to wrap it up, like how most giallo films try to wrap it up, it then feels like a Scooby-Doo ending, and it just feels kind of like cheaper and not in a fun way. And so I kind of like leaving it up to the audience. So I'm not shocked that it's unfinished. However, I have a lot of questions about the opening scene, mm-hmm. and because that the first murder we see is a switchblade to the knife, a young girl, sorry, spoilers, a young girl like kills this man, and that's the only kind of murder we see with a weapon. It's the only like single person, like on person murder, and it just doesn't really fit. Mm-hmm. And that feels like one of those like subplots that went nowhere. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering if they did finish it, would that somehow have been tied all together? The beginning just really makes me think.
Yeah. I like it. It just kind of adds, again, like just this creepy town full of secrets.
Yeah, definitely a town full of secrets.
Yeah. Which is a totally different like subgenre altogether. So we have like Dead and Buried, Children of the Corn, and House of Wax, which this film also reminded me of, like the Paris Hilton House of Wax.
Oh my God, I haven't seen that in years.
It's so good.
I saw that. That was one of those horror movies that like stuck with me for a very long time. Mm-hmm. I'm a bit of like a scaredy cat, so that's why I really take to like 60s and 70s horror, because there's such like a humor to them, but Paris Hilton's House of Wax, that one got me.
I love how it's credited as Paris Hilton's House of Wax.
I think she's got a lot of really good titles to her name.
Yeah.
They say that nightmares are dreams perverted. I've told them here it wasn't a nightmare, but they don't believe me. They nod and make little notes in my file, and they watch me now, waiting for me to scar my breasts, to eat insects maybe, or to lift my dress like some
crazy old woman and urinate on the floor. But there's so little time left. You've got to listen. Not far from here, there's a small town on the coast. They used to call it New Bethlehem, but they changed the name to Point Dune after the moon turned blood red. Point Dune doesn't look any different than 1,000 other neon stucco towns. But what happened there, what they did to me, what they're doing now, they're coming here. They're waiting at the edge of the city. They're peering around buildings at night. And they're waiting. They're waiting for you. And they'll take you one by one, and no one will hear you scream. No one will hear you scream!
Here from WeAreCult.rocks, kind of about the style of the film and the ending and all that. So much of the film is reminiscent of Herc Harvey's sole directorial effort, the classic Carnival of Souls from 1962, but with a giallo aesthetic. Influentially, it is Woman in Trouble plot, point of view shots of headlights on the highways at night, Edward Hopper influenced widescreen cinematography, and art direction by Eraserhead and Mulholland Drive production designer Jack Fisk. It occasionally evokes 90s era David Lynch by way of 70s grindhouse. And I guess, yeah, the kind of like Lynch connection too, where it almost feels like dreamlike and there isn't necessarily like a linear sort of narrative that makes complete sense.
Yeah, and we deal with like Arletty grappling with kind of her own madness and not being certain if she's in a dream, and we're not certain if she's in a dream. Mm-hmm. And so yeah, definitely I can see the Lynch-esque mm-hmm. Moments of it. And yeah, also like I feel like I didn't give a great definition of giallo in the beginning, and now I'm just throwing little bits and pieces mm-hmm. in the middle. But giallo also deals a lot with like the supernatural mm-hmm. and like women as witches or women as like these magical beings that usually bring on destruction. Mm. And so thinking about her as not only a woman in peril plot point, but also like a woman who is bringing this terror indirectly to the town. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. Also like if you're thinking of it compared to the birds or something like that, this kind of young woman sort of like bringing this chaos with her.
Yeah, totally. Mm-hmm. Like the best way to get somebody to follow you is to tell them not to follow you or to run away from them, which we see like 3 or 4 times in the film. Yeah. Somebody runs and you gotta follow.
There is a lot of scenes of just people running around in the streets.
Yeah, it's actually a really quiet movie when you think mm-hmm. about it. Like there's not a ton of dialogue, mm-hmm. But you also, at least through my watchings, I never felt bored. I was never like, they keep that tone and that eeriness going mm-hmm. and they do a really good job of it, I think. Mm-hmm.
There were a couple of points where I felt like it was following Tom maybe a bit too much, where I would have liked to see like more development with Arletty.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Also mm-hmm. There's a scene where Tom gets attacked. Mm-hmm. It has a very like interesting editing choice where it is a mob that's following him, but that it cuts and he's attacked by a single individual. Mm-hmm. And then we see him just kind of roaming around for a bit. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think Tom is very charismatic as a character. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad he was there, but I want less of him.
Yeah, less of it. Like, it is interesting to see him kind of like interacting with the ghouls in a certain way and sort of, because he also comes across a young woman who doesn't know that she's like turned. Mm-hmm. Remember, and like, and then she has like one single red tear and she's like, oh, it's too late. So that's kind of like telling us like more about this like curse or this cult or whatever. But I just like I like a detective in a movie, and so I would have liked to see like more of Arletty sort of like discovering her own, I guess. Yeah. But she's also going through it. So
yeah. Again, that's why I thought so much of like Invasion of the Body Snatchers, where like this thing happens to you and you're kind of aware of it, but you're kind of not. Mm-hmm. And so in that scene where he meets that girl with the single tear, and then also then cutting to Arletty, who is like stabbing herself with a needle to see if she feels pain and all of that, like, yeah, that self-discovery of, mm-hmm. I guess, evil.
So yeah, I have another quote here. From We Are Cult.rocks, kind of about the motivations of the characters, that which seem kind of murky at times. So a definitive explanation as to what the hell is going on is always just out of reach. We're given a collection of facts, a legend of a blood moon, a series of gruesome murders, mysterious gatherings on the beach, and a stream of sinister goings on. But we're never quite sure if we're the victim of a Caligari-esque unreliable narrator. Michael Greer's character, Tom, in particular, is highly enigmatic. His motives seem rather vague, and though he's firmly on Arletty's side, the actor has a dual role, not only as Tom, but as the briefly glimpsed dark stranger as well. That's kind of what I was expecting with the end, that like he would return as the dark stranger, but I think that's the scene that they weren't able to shoot.
That makes sense. And yeah, going back to what I was thinking about with like the Manson murders and cults, like in a way, Tom and his two traveling companions, who are lovely, are like their own little cults. And then we have the, you know, the flesh-eating zombies, who are also their own cult, worshiping the dark stranger. And just, yeah, seeing that overlap. Yeah, I could see that being the final scene for sure.
Mm-hmm. And we do get a glimpse of it kind of in a flashback sequence. So Arletty is kind of like tied on the beach, and she has this like massive wig for some reason. And then the dark stranger sort of like approaching her, but there's no conclusion. And like when I first watched it, I was kind of frustrated, but I think like with movies like Messiah of Evil, you kind of just have to like give into the mood and sort of like follow the movie on its own terms and by its own rules, you know? And like, it's definitely more based on mood than reality. And I think trying to decipher the story can kind of ruin it.
Yeah, it's like exactly what you were saying. And then also with that quote, like trying to figure out what the hell is going on is just going to make you frustrated. Mm-hmm. And then again, with all the different like subplots that kind of lead to nowhere, like the truck driver who we meet at in the beginning, who has all of the dead bodies in his truck, like that goes nowhere, but he is kind of this antagonist character we meet a few times. And also like the dark stranger, if you were to do a re-edit of that whole film and just take out all the dark stranger stuff, it would still be an enjoyable watch. One part about the dark stranger that I absolutely loved was when her father was telling her the lore, and the dark stranger walks through a fire pit, but he's wearing these big cowboy boots, and I'm like, this is the cheapest stunt to do. Like, I can do that. Like, this is quintessential 70s on a dime, like, exploitation film. Like, ooh, look how scary I am.
Yeah, it looks like a tough guy. And their budget was like $12. So.
Oh, perfect. Yeah. So that cost 50 cents.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So yeah, so we can talk a little bit about the cult in a little bit more detail. So I love cults. I love cults in movies. I think they're so fun and like fascinating as like a phenomenon. So the cult in this movie, they're kind of like, they're waiting on the beach for the return of the dark stranger during the blood moon. And they're this like cult of like cannibals and the undead, while also being kind of religious in a way, or just sort of like waiting for their god, which is the dark stranger, which is, he was this like sinister preacher that may be a survivor of the Donner Party, and he wishes to spread his cannibal religion across America. The symptoms of the cult and sort of this like ghoulishness seems to be contagious. So either the ghouls attack someone and then they turn into a ghoul, or the longer some people spend in Point Doom, they seem to show symptoms. So like Arletty, like I don't think she's bitten, I could be wrong, but it just seems like the longer that she spends in Point Doom, the more she descends into this madness and experiences symptoms like puking up bugs and not feeling pain and sort of like stabbing herself and all that.
Yeah. I don't think I can recall a scene where she's ever really like attacked. Mm-hmm. And before she kind of starts descending into this, but then I did in my initial viewing of this, I mm-hmm. kind of read it as if she was almost like the chosen one. I hate that verbiage. Mm-hmm. But her dad being this figure in the town that's kind of feared but also kind of revered, and he is like talking about the Dark Stranger, and then she is then offered to the Dark Stranger at the end. So I read it almost as like they're using him to get to her, right, to bring her here, and she's, yeah, again, I hate that word, but like the chosen one.
That's similar to Wicker Man. How have you seen the 1970s?
No, it's actually on my watch list for tonight.
Oh, yeah. Well, let me know what you think of it. Yeah, it kind of shares. There's some threads that are shared for sure. But yeah, this kind of like sacrificial lamb almost of a character.
Yeah. And maybe that's just me like trying to explain the plot too much and mm-hmm. going against what we just said of like just let the tone take you. Mm-hmm. But with the way that like the townspeople and the cult kind of react to her father, at first you're almost like led to believe that he might be the Dark Stranger. Mm. Because they talk about him with so much power and like fear, mm-hmm. and what he really wants to talk about her dad. But yet all we're doing is talking about her dad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Father?
Valerie, I tried to warn you. I dragged one of the bodies they killed up on the beach, but you still didn't leave. Little time left. You'll have to go. Tell people on the outside. Warn them that what happened 100 years ago is happening again.
What?
Listen. Please listen. It came 100 years ago. A hunter first saw him.
He told the hunter that he had been a minister and had come over the mountains with the Donner Party. He passed that horrible winter with them and saw men commit hideous acts. He said that he himself had eaten human flesh, but had survived because he had faith. Faith in a new master. The hunter didn't understand. When the Dark Stranger said he was spreading this new religion. When they found the hunter, he looked as if he'd been attacked by some kind of animal, half eaten. As he was dying, he told them of the Dark Stranger. And they assumed he was delirious. When he went into a fit, biting at them like a rabid dog, they shot him. The Dark Stranger watched the chaos. And he walked into the sea and said he would return 100 years later to a world tired and disillusioned, a world looking back to old gods and old dark ways. Our world. You've got to go now. Most of this town is infected. It's got to be destroyed before the moon turns blood red. And he returns to lead them up the coast and inland into the cities.
We can both go.
Like, I thought the scene with the old man who is drunk was really interesting, mm-hmm. how they shot it, because they frame him like up against next to a television, and that's the only time we ever really get like the full center focal point, and mm-hmm. it keeps flipping back and forth, and he's next to this dormant television that almost looks like thinking of him as entertainment, and like mm-hmm. how kind of cringy it is that they just are plying him with booze and using him for mm-hmm. their information. And yeah, like thinking about the motivations of Tom and his two like traveling companions. Mm-hmm. That was something I thought a lot about, but I have no answers on.
Right. Yeah. That character is interesting because, yeah, he's kind of, I feel like that actor plays the sort of like town drunk quite a bit. But he's also like has knowledge of the town and of Arletty's father too, that he tries to.
Yeah. And he's like, killed off immediately after.
Off screen too.
Yeah, just makes me think they couldn't afford him for any more scenes.
Oh, maybe, yeah. They only had him for a day.
Because I feel like that would really, it's almost a missed opportunity with the storytelling again. Another huge missed opportunity, what in my opinion, was in the beginning at the gas station. She's talking to the gas station attendant and he's like, why would you want to go there? It's deader than hell. And they didn't use that as their tagline. Yeah. Deader than hell. Point Dune, deader than hell. That's amazing.
That's pretty good.
And like, I was on IMDb looking at their taglines. I think I have it right here. And they were so bad. In order to live, they will take you one by one and no one will hear you scream, which I think is a direct quote from the film. And then the other ones were terror you won't want to remember in a film you won't be able to forget, which is so just general. Mm-hmm. And then meet Albert. Albert likes good music, motor trips by the moonlight, and eating human flesh. Albert is one of the dead people. Like,
oh yeah, because it had a bunch of different names too, rather than Messiah of Evil.
Yeah, it was just none of them. Point Dune, deader than hell.
Is it Point Dune or Point Doom? I read multiple versions.
It might be, it's probably Point Doom. D-U-M-E?
Yeah, because I think that's a real place in California. But
yeah, and like the California vibes, again, with the with that housing development. I thought a lot about that housing development and just like the kind of consumerism elements that you get when you think about zombie films. Like how often are we going to see zombies attack people in a shopping center? But then also just like how that area is kind of becoming cookie cutter. And there's that line where if there was a line, I wish I could remember it now, if all the world was burnt down, it would be rebuilt to look like this. And yes, it's just like these cookie cutter, like, yeah, town with a secret where it's all so whitewashed. And that's where evil can fester.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I wish this had, because I think, did you watch this on YouTube?
I ripped it off YouTube, yeah.
Yeah, I watched it too. And I wish there was like a better cut of it because it's so dark. It would be nice to see it kind of like brightened up and cleaned up a little bit and maybe released with a better tagline.
Yeah, okay, so that's a project for us.
yeah, for sure. Another element that I really enjoyed and I think is kind of like Lovecraftian is it's sort of bookended with shots of Arletty in an asylum.
Yeah.
Like after the events of the film. And so you have the sense of the unreliable narrator and sort of, what was a dream? What was real? What actually happened?
Totally. Mm-hmm. And when she's in, I guess, the courtyard of the asylum, and there's like doctors and other people around, extras. I was trying to see if it was from somebody else from the film, not only for like a cost perspective, but also like adding to the fact like of her being unreliable potentially. Mm. And I couldn't figure it out, but.
You know. Or like how the cult or the curse is like spreading. And so the people from the town are sort of like creeping out into the rest of the world.
Yeah, I really actually quite liked those voiceover scenes where she is potentially mad. Like the beginning is so eerie, and which also made me think about why I had a problem, not a problem, but questions about the first scene, because it goes that first scene with the switchblade murder, then credits, then the next opening scene, which is her at the asylum, and then more credits. And I was like, what is going on here? Yeah. With the cutting. Yeah,
it's an interesting movie.
Yeah, like it's definitely, I am very glad I watched it. I think that it is also in dialogue with a lot of films from that time, also just kind of like fits the kind of cookie cutter mold of giallo lights and also like 70s exploitation, but like not going full on into both. It's just, yeah, exploitation light, I guess, too.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, because it's not very gory. It's not super sexy. But it has like a grimy uneasiness to it.
Yeah, and like obviously very like cheaply made, but still very attuned to aesthetics. Like aesthetics are the most important usually in these types of films. Mm-hmm. And yeah, thinking also about the director writer pair and reading some interviews with them about how they were kind of pretentious in their making of it because they just took from all places and had a lot of illusions. I just think that. Yeah, I definitely would recommend this film to people, but I don't know if I would say, oh, you're going to love it.
Yeah, it is cool to think of them, like how they consider it pretentious, but I don't know, they just seem like film fans.
Yeah.
Right? And like are trying, like I think all filmmakers do that, or all like artists do that. They sort of like bring sort of bits of genres that they're fans of, I think.
Yeah, I guess like thinking though, and I was not around in the 70s in California, but wondering if a lot of folks there were watching like Italian horror at that time. And maybe like that's also, they went to have like quite the career with, the Star Wars guy. What's his name?
George Lucas, yeah.
Bad film person.
Yeah. yeah, you're canceled for not knowing who George Lucas is.
So like they kind of had a more mainstream career. So I think like them calling themselves pretentious is maybe just a way to protect themselves from criticism from their mainstream buddies.
Maybe. But they did a treatment of the Star Wars script, and apparently Gloria Katz, is that who?
Yeah.
Gloria Katz. She apparently developed the Princess Leia character so that she's like a bit of a more like well-rounded kind of sassy person.
Love it.
And then she was uncredited.
Not fair.
No.
I think this actually ended up, now that I'm like remembering my pandemic research, I think this ended up on my list because I was interested in Gloria Katz specifically because I was looking for kind of like exploitation films that were done by women. I think that's how I initially came across this, and it was too bad that she was uncredited as the director here as well. But did get some credits with like the screenwriting and
producing and stuff too.
Yeah,
it's cool. Thank you so much for suggesting it.
Yeah, thank you for having me. This has been so much fun.
Where can people find your work and your zines?
This is like a good reminder for me to make a website, but the best part probably just my Instagram, which is at Teresa Bernice, Teresa with no H. And yeah, there'll be a new zine coming out in May. And I also still have copies of my last one, Letters to John Goodman and Exploration in Anticipatory Grief. And yeah, some more projects probably soon.
Cool. Yeah. Thanks so much for being on the show.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me.
And you can listen to Bikini Drive-In every Sunday at 4 p.m. on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. You can follow me on Instagram at Bikini Drive-In. There's a Facebook page, Bikini Drive-In, and Twitter, Bikini Drive-In, everywhere. All right, thanks. Bye.
powered by volunteer community involvement. This is CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg.